Serious. I prayed long and hard to God for the salvation of my brother and yourself, for the love I bear you both. God listened to many of us these past days, I think. I smiled, for I prayed within the sick room and within the cathedral. I took the bones of the healer saint, Saint Ravenis, and kept them with my lord. Odo lifted his eyebrows. You know, my lady, that I am blessed enough to own many bones, almost the whole bodies, I believe, of the brother saints Ravenis and Rasiphus, including their skulls, after their decapitations by the Goths. There are many miracles that we have ascribed to their holy remains in my lands. Then to those miracles add this one, I insisted. For my lord was on the verge of death, and yet he was saved. Was it so very close, then? Odo asked, glancing at William, who was talking with Guy, Count of Ponthieu, an ally of ours ever since his capture at the Battle of Mortimer, where he had sworn fealty to my husband in return for his freedom, flanked by him and the smaller figure of our son, Robert, who looked pleased to be so included in his father's conversation. William continued, unawares that I was worrying his brother with the full truth of his late illness. It is hard to imagine he was so ill, looking now so well and hearty. Believe it, my lord bishop. A hard edge rode my voice. I am no woman to be dismayed by a light sweat. An ill smell. My lord was sick unto death. It is only because of his vigor and strength, and the intervention of the saints and God himself, that he stands before you now. I would never doubt your word, my lady, Odo assured me. We must be grateful, then, for his recovery, and it would seem to come at a fortuitous time for the future of our lands. How so? I asked, taking a cup of wine from Adela, who came up carrying it for me. Odo's gaze slid slowly from my face to that of the girl at my side. His pupils widened in admiration, and I saw a naughty, lustful look pass onto his smiling mouth. Odo, I cut sharply through whatever thoughts had been roaming through his mind. He turned his gaze back to me, removing it reluctantly from the blushing face of my maid. My apologies, my lady. He snuck another look at my servant as she stood at my side, trying not to look on the leering bishop. I was captivated by the beauty of your new lady, and I could not help but admire her. As long as admire is all that you do, brother, I said primly, my ladies are not for any man to touch. I am a man of the cloth, dear sister. He widened his eyes in mock innocence. And I am a woman of the world, dear brother. I took his arm to lead him to the tables. I know well enough that whilst the bishop in you may be as chaste as the virginal moon, the lord within you carries as much red blood as any other man. Leave my ladies alone, dear brother. I know well enough you have many of your own to warm your bed. Odo laughed heartily and pressed my hand. Then admire is all I will do, dear sister, with your personal ladies at least. Think you that I care for any of the others? Take as you will from the lower orders, as long as you have their consent, brother. My own household is my concern. I cannot watch over every soul in the world. We processed to the head table, and the feasting commenced with vigor. Servants came in vast throngs, carrying roasted venison, hog sausages, beef and pepper sauce, carp, pike and turbot, all poached in white wine and spice. Capons dripping in rich wine gravy were put on the tables alongside pork pies with ginger, light crusty breads, and tangy leeks bobbing in steaming savory pottage. Roasted pheasants, peacocks, and cockerels made the table groan. Delicate green leaves of tumbled herbs and wild leaves shone bright under the tallow candles with oil and lemon juice, and vast cauldrons of shrimp and crab burst vibrant colors of pink and white into the murky, savory depths of flavorsome broths. Onto my bread trencher I put but a taste of each fine dish, but William, Odo, Robert, and Erluon, to my one side, and my son Robert to the other, heaved heavy portions to theirs, devouring them with zest, and swilling them down with deep ruby wine and amber ale. "What did you mean, my lord?" I asked, turning to Odo as he sighed and held his bulging stomach with contentment. "That this was a fortuitous time for Normandy." Odo reached for his goblet. I felt William turn to his brother also.
"There is a rumour, my lady," Odo said, "that Edward of England is declining in health. I have had it from a member of Edward's own court, who came visiting my cathedral on his way to the Holy Lands, that the king is a dying man. His thanes are trying to keep it quiet, but a well-intentioned bribe helped loosen the tongue of the pilgrim at my table." Odo looked up at his brother with expectant eyes. "The time comes close, brother, to make good on your promise to Edward made so long ago. One may even say this is the purpose for which God has preserved you."
William looked at him and drank from his goblet.
"I am not reluctant to keep my word, Odo. Yet I hear rumours sneaking from England that when Edward dies, the Godwins will make a move for his throne. Harold Godwinson has the support of the Danes and many Saxons at court in England, and the backing, they say, of the common people. He hails from the ancient line of the House of Wessex, and has been a known warrior and respected thane in his country."
"That man has no claim," I spat,
perhaps more loudly than I should, and then smiled a look on William's amused face. "Forgive me, my lords, but the throne was promised to my husband by King Edward himself, and through the royal blood that both my husband and I contain of the line of England. It does not rest on some flimsy alliance with a house of the Danish kings who, I might remind us all, do not reign in England any more. And who is Harold? An earl, with but light links to the ancient line of Wessex? That does not make him the heir to the throne. I have more blood of Alfred the Great in my veins than he."
"Be that as it may, my love," said William, stabbing slippery poached pears in red wine and honey with his knife, and putting them on a fresh-cut trencher. "The English know Harold already, whereas I am a lord foreign to them. There's also the great-nephew of Edward, Edgar, son of Edward the Exile, who was the son of Edmund Ironside. Edward the Exile is dead, probably at the hands of the Godwins, but his son is yet living. The boy is a child, but he is of the bloodline of the present king and has been named Atheling, which shows the Saxons already consider him for the throne. If King Edward does not reiterate his request for me to take the throne after he dies, we will find less support for our claim."
"Would you let that stand in your way, brother?" asked Robert heatedly.
William smiled slowly and looked out at the hall.
"Oh no, brother," he said, narrowing his eyes. "I merely make it my business to know all there is to know about a land I mean to rule. The other claimants to my titles must be taken into account in my plans. But all this really means is that we may face a fight when we come to lay claim to England."
His lips broke into a wicked smile as he turned to Robert.
"And you know well enough how much I enjoy a good fight."
Robert burst into riotous laughter. Odo and Erluan did the same. I smiled at William's chuckling face. William raised his cup.
"To the claims of other men to the titles I own," he shouted,
to the surprise of the collected nobles of Normandy.
"May their plotting ever keep my sword sharp, my wits keen, and my ambition strong and hearty."
There was a bellow of laughter from the hall as others raised their goblets to their warlike lord. Fitzosborne and Montgomery were cheering from the back of the hall, thumping on the tables with their huge fists. I pressed my hand to William's arm.
"You will be the King of England, my love," I said warmly, for a wise woman once said to me, "What is true, and sometimes it just takes a little work to make sure that your truth becomes the truth."
He smiled at me, that crooked, handsome smile.
"A little work is then what we must undertake, wife," he agreed. "For I can think of nothing I would like than to see you honored as the queen you are."
My heart swelled with love and pride. My love, my husband, my William. He was going to become a king, a true king, and the most powerful man who walked this earth. It was just as I had wished when first I came to be his wife.
Chapter 31. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. There are times in life when it seems as though the hand of God intervenes directly in our lives, bringing to us events or persons that may be of deep value to us, if we only understand how to make use of them. Such times have happened frequently in my life, convincing me that God in the heavens had oftentimes looked down on our mortal lives played out beneath him, and stepped in to give advantage to our cause. As the abbess had said to me, it seemed I could hear God's voice and understand his will, at times. Just as the spring flowers were bursting forth from the snow-bound caverns of their winter coverings, and the birds began to rejoice for the arrival of warmer weather, Odo came riding with all haste to Rouen. We had not been expecting him. So when the word came from a messenger that the Bishop of Bayeux was almost within sight of the city, William sent for me and our eldest son, Robert. Since his illness and brush with death, William had taken more interest in Robert and his education as the future Duke of Normandy. With my husband's new lands in Maine added to our already formidable territories in Normandy, our house was in its highest level of ascendancy since the Viking lords had reigned. But William's illness seemed to have convinced him finally that he was not immortal, and needed to make preparation for the future of our house. Taking Robert with him into meetings with his advisers, riding with him up and down our territories, and trying at all times to fire Robert's mind with the politics and persuasions of ruling a vast kingdom, had become an obsession to William. I would like to tell you that this active interest in his 11-year-old heir brought my husband and our son closer together, and perhaps in some ways it did. But their arguments and discussions were as heated as the blacksmith's fire. Each of them was convinced that theirs was the only way to view a situation, and each of them was as stubborn as the other. Neither would admit when they had been wrong. My traditional role as peacekeeper of the household had never been so tested. when we were at the castle of Rouen, and my other sons could join them, William brought Richard and Rufus to the table, often to go over past strategies of war, dealings with lords who had supported William's claims over their then-masters, or the rudiments of what forces to use in which situation in battle. Our chambers became filled with the grumbles of men discussing war, and resounded with a cheer of approval when one or other of them would come to a successful conclusion to a phantom fight. William, perhaps, could not see, as I did, that he favoured Richard, although he was younger, over Robert, and that this favouritism was causing rifts even deeper than before, between my husband and his first-born heir. Richard was maturing into a young man with more balance and calm-headed collectedness than his elder brother. Richard, even though he was only 10, would assess the situation with unruffled consideration before offering a course of action or conclusion. Robert was much more heated, more like the uncle for whom he was named, more like his father had been when he was young. Robert would rush in, announce a plan, and refuse to be dissuaded from it. This infuriated William. Perhaps it was because he unconsciously saw so many of his own faults in Robert that William came down on him harder than our cool, composed Richard. But, for whatever reason, William's frustrations with our eldest son and his desire to see him achieve more than he seemed presently capable were forcing a hard wedge between the two of them. No matter how much placating and mending I did, melding the two of them together was starting to become an uphill struggle. "Why not ride for Brittany today, then?" asked Robert at one such meeting, his face fired with imaginings of war glory. With men secured as our own, rebellious lords in Brittany had asked for William's help in overthrowing their present lord. If he aided them, then they had promised to name him overlord of Brittany, as long as they, too, shared in the spoils of conquest. "Today is almost over, son," said William, his jaw clenching with frustration. "Think you that a campaign can be won if one simply rides out as soon as one rebel offers a kingdom?" "No, father," Robert spoke with an ominous tone in his voice. "But clearly there's not just one lord, but many. And besides," he sniffed dismissively, "it is not as though the forces mustered in Brittany are anything compared to ours. We can crush them and take the lands for Normandy." "Would it not perhaps be of an advantage to secure the promises of all the rebel lords in advance and in writing, brother?" Richard interjected carefully. "I would agree that our numbers and skill are vastly superior, but after we have won their war for them, what will hold them to their promises? Would it not be of advantage to know we have secured the oaths of the rebels of Brittany in writing before engaging our forces?" Richard spoke delicately, for he knew his brother's temper and was always keen to placate it. There was nothing in his tone which signalled any disrespect. He sought only to give advice. William grunted with approval at Richard, and turned to Robert. "You see," he asked, "even your younger brother can use more reason than you."
"My brother's reasoning is sound in my view, father," disagreed Richard, ever the peacemaker. Robert flashed him a grateful look. "He assesses rightly that the opposite army is no threat to ours," Richard continued, "and I agree with him."
"But he does not wait to consider other opportunities, problems, or considerations before he acts," cried William, running his hands through his short hair.
Robert glowered across the table. I sighed and laid a hand on the shoulder of young Rufus. He was almost 5, and such lengthy discussions were often hard for his small body to endure. "Sometimes I slipped out with him when the others were occupied with fighting each other. William rarely noticed, so obsessed was he with trying to batter his eldest son into thinking the same way as he did.
"When one is in command of a superior force," insisted Robert, "it is in the best interests of others who are weaker to defer to that force. Otherwise, they will be squashed. The lords of Brittany know well enough the fierce reputation of the Normans, and they will not move to betray us once we have given our aid."
"They would not dare, my lord." He added his father's title, almost as an afterthought. Another slip bound to rile his father's temper further.
"How do you know that?"
demanded William, the color rising in his cheeks.
"A rebel's promise is scarcely more than words, even at the best of times. These lords are already rising up against the lord they once swore to obey and defend. They are oath-breakers. Why should they not turn on us once our usefulness is fulfilled?"
Robert studied his father's face, and then pulled a face of dismissive disgust.
"If they would act in such a traitorous manner, then they are all false knaves, father."
"There are many such in this world," William informed him with a grim face, "and reputation and forces will only take a man so far. Any man will fall to the hand of death if a dagger is struck true between his shoulder blades. No matter if it is an oath-breaker or a true knight who wields it. Any man may die in battle, not through lack of skill, but for lack of luck. Cover every eventuality, then you can see, and do not simply ride into battle depending on but one of your advantages."
Robert and Richard both nodded at William. I could see Richard's mind working inside his head like a water wheel, thrashing through and using all the information he could glean from his father's experience. Richard would one day become a lord whose mind dictated his actions. He would be ruthless and powerful, and when he was grown, he would be a lord to be feared for the cool, methodical detachment of his mind. I could see that in him even now, even as young as he was. But my eldest son was made of fire even as his brother was of ice. Robert may listen to the words that William spoke, but he would heed only the feral call of his own heart and imagination when he grew to be a man. I was not displeased to see this either. Bold action and fierce courage may win much in this world, and may make many tremble. Robert's temper made him unpredictable, just as Richard's cold calm made him equally so in some ways. My eldest sons would make their names known in the pages of history. I knew it, and I was proud of them. Rufus looked up at me and smirked at my whimsical expression as I surveyed the men in my life with my usual mixed feelings of frustration and pride. He giggled at my face. William looked up at our youngest son and frowned at his mirth.
"What would you do, Rufus?" he asked.
Rufus looked around at his father and grinned broadly. "I'd hit them so hard that they wouldn't have time to get up before I killed them all, my lord father," he said, without blinking.
William chortled. "So, rather than keep the rebel lords in place to rule under you, you would simply kill them?" Rufus shrugged.
"There are always more lords, my lord father," he said carelessly, as though it were a foolish question.
William's face broke into the skewed grin I loved so, as he regarded his bloodthirsty youngest son.
"Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength," quoted William.
Robert was glowering as William gazed with approval at Rufus. Although what our youngest son had said was not so very different from the words of the eldest, it seemed that Robert's ideas would never find full favor with his father.
The discussion continued, and eventually
I took Rufus from the chamber to his lessons, under deep protest, even as his father and brothers continued to wrangle. So, we were, when Odo came to us, ruddy-cheeked from riding hard, a surprisingly small party of men accompanying him. He had left Bayeux in a hurry to get to us, and the reason, it seemed, was of extreme importance to our house.
"This is a strange season to see you, brother," William observed as Odo was ushered into our chambers.
I poured wine, handed a goblet to William and to Odo, and then offered one to my eldest son. Robert looked up gratefully to be treated as an adult, equal to the other men, in being served by me. I gave him a small, slight wink, and he repressed a chuckle. Odo drank deep of his wine and then let out a sigh.
"Ugh! It feels good to wash the dust from my throat."
He looked at William with excitement, hovering over his handsome face like the clouds as they blanket the sun.
"I bring important news, brother, and I do not wish to send it by messenger."
Odo grinned widely, and I was struck by the cast of his fine-looking face in the dappled light that came from the window. All the sons of Erleva were handsome, and each in a way different, too. And yet, in other ways, they were so similar to each other. She had blessed them with her easy charm and grace. Odo and Robert had brown eyes and dark hair, where William's eyes were blue and his hair was golden red. Yet, in their faces, their mother's looks had bred true in all of them.
"It would seem that God is looking upon us with favor," Odo beamed,
his fingers moving over the goblet he held, tapping up and down.
"I was sent word from Count Guy of Ponthieu that a rather distinguished guest had been shipwrecked and brought to his court. The man was apparently on his way to visit with your brother in Flanders, my lady, in all honor and accompanied by a full guard. He wanted to negotiate with you, William, through your brother-in-law of Flanders, for the release of certain prisoners, lord to lord, as equals. But his ship was thrown off course and capsized in the storms, killing almost all on board, and forcing him to crawl to the house of Count Guy. Guy took him prisoner, as is the custom in Ponthieu, with uninvited guests, as he was planning to ransom him. Guy did not believe who his captive was, at first, as he believed him to be a common pirate."
William was staring at Odo with an expression of slight confusion.
"Negotiate for the release of prisoners?"
Odo's face was clearly delighted with this guessing game, as he strung out the answer with glee. William knew his younger brother well enough to play without even seeming to realize it.
"And he came by sea, you say?"
William pondered, and then something seemed to knock into place in his mind. He looked sharply up at Odo, and a broad smile spread slowly over his face. Odo cackled with delight, pounding one of his great hands hard on the armrest of his chair.
"Yes, brother," he exclaimed.
"Excuse me, my lords," I hissed waspishly, growing annoyed with their brotherly game of talking to each other without actually revealing anything. "But the rest of us do not know the significance or identity of this visitor."
William turned his lopsided smile to me, beaming, with a fiendish glint in his eyes.
"Harold Godwinson, Earl of Wessex. I hold prisoners who are his kin, his younger brother, Wulfnoth, and nephew, Hakon. They have been our guests since the Archbishop came to give me King Edward's offer. If you recall, my love, the prisoners were granted to me as security for Edward's promise that I become his heir, and Godwinson is the only lord of the many that I hold prisoner of, who should come to claim them by sea."
William turned to Odo.
"Where is he now?"
Odo looked as though he might piss himself with merriment.
Ye took him prisoner, brother. I am told he locked Harold up in slave chains and shackled him to the walls in his prisons. I imagine the Earl of Wessex was most put out to be treated like a common pirate. Harold asked that word be sent to me and to you, to petition for his release, since you are Guy's liege lord. But Guy did not know you had recently moved the court to Rouen, so the messengers went to the wrong place. As soon as I got the missive, I rode with all haste to you myself. This is an opportunity not to be missed.
Robert frowned. What will you do with him?
William tapped his finger on his goblet thoughtfully.
As yet, I am unsure, he admitted. But to have one of my possible rivals for the crown of England wash up defenseless on my shores, just as King Edward sickens, cannot be just chance.
He looked at me and lifted his eyebrows.
Perhaps God is showing a mark of favor to us in these events.
If God offers us a chance at any advantage, I urged, then we should take it, my lord. But the Earl cannot be treated like a common prisoner.
That does no good for your reputation. He cannot remain in Guy's dungeons. But I agree, there is much here to use to our advantage.
I paused, and then rushed on. You could make Harold swear allegiance to you as the future King of England, my lord husband. If he kept to his word, then he could be a powerful ally in the fight for England.
If he kept to his word, William echoed grimly.
You think he would not?
I would not.
What if such an oath were made as public as possible? Asked Robert, sitting forward. If there were many witnesses to such an oath, then his honor would be polluted by going back on his word.
William let out a grunt, which was the closest thing to an expression of approval that Robert ever really got.
Even so, he mused, I would rather risk a broken honor for a kingdom.
Odo was stroking the top of his goblet with a ponderous finger, and staring at it circling the rim as he thought.
What if he risked more than just his honor, brother?
What do you mean? I asked.
What if he risked his very soul by going back on a promise made?
Odo asked.
What if he risked the abandonment of God?
You mean to have him swear on the Bible, or perhaps on a relic of the holy saints?
I said thoughtfully, catching his meaning.
But would he ever agree to do it?
And in public? He would know well enough the seriousness of such an oath.
We would have him captive, sniffed Robert. If he ever wanted to be free again, then he would have little choice but to swear. Perhaps he would be more amenable if he did not realize he was swearing on a relic until after the fact, smiled Odo, gazing up with wicked eyes at William. I have an altar with a space under it that is used to house and protect the bones and bodies of saints. A vow becomes a holy one, unbreakable by the will of men, when a man swears on that altar. But if the man cannot see what is under the altar he swears upon,
William smirked, warming to the idea.
And if there were enough witnesses, then Harold's supporters would know well enough that if he betrayed his vow, then God would abandon him for breaking a holy promise. Following a leader forsaken by God makes for nervous soldiers and supporters.
That does not surprise me, Father,
Robert said, shivering slightly.
I would not wish to ride to battle knowing that I had been deserted by God, or that the Lord I served had been...
Or that those you faced were on the side of God, I added, that God supported your enemies, whilst our Lord had turned his face from you.
William rose and walked to the window. He narrowed his eyes as he looked out into the misty skies.
It would seem that we have been given an opportunity, indeed,
and I hate to see those wasted. We could, of course, simply kill the Earl and have done with it.
And create a martyr for the Danes and Saxons who follow him? I asked, skeptically.
You would find fewer supporters for our cause in England, and brand Normandy a land without honour, my lord.
Besides, there are many Godwinsons. Godwin seems to have bred heirs as flies breed maggots. One of the younger sons would only step into their brother's place.
I would counsel to keep the man alive, and to use him. Use him for all the advantage Normandy can gain from this happy accident of fate.
William nodded.
You speak wise counsel, my lady, he agreed. And, who knows, perhaps the Saxon may turn out to be a true and powerful ally. The Godwinsons have long been at the elbow of power, and many prefer to stay there, for they reap the benefits of power without the full responsibility of all it entails. We will find a way to make him swear fealty to us, although how we are to persuade him to do so freely remains to be seen.
He turned his head to his brother.
Send word to our brother, Robert, he commanded, and ride for Ponthieu. Commend Guy in private for taking Harold prisoner, but let him understand that when I get there I must publicly censure him for treating an important lord like a common prisoner. Let Guy know that he will be well rewarded for taking Harold prisoner, no matter what I might say against him in public.
William's laugh barked from his mouth like a hound sounding a warning in the night.
I do hope Guy actually put Harold in a cell. I would truly love to see that. The Earls of Wessex have long believed themselves to be the most powerful of all thanes. Such a humiliation would be unbearable to his pride.
And you, brother? Asked Odo. What will you do next?
We shall be at your heels,
William informed him.
Bring Harold to Ur. I shall meet him there with great pomp, and we will bring him to Rouen. We will treat him as an honored guest, but until we have what we want of him, he will not be allowed to leave. I am curious to meet him. They say he is a formidable warrior. I have studied his recent campaigns against the traitorous Earl Ulfgar and the Welsh prince, Llewelyn ap Gruffydd. He seems to understand the power of fear and negotiation well.
Robert snorted contemptuously, and William turned on him.
You make a grave mistake to underestimate one you have never even met or apprised for yourself, Robert. Such airs can be costly.
Robert went red. His flaming face scowled to be upbraided in front of his uncle.
I underestimate no one, father, he glowered. But I also trust little the truth of anything said by they, for it seems they always have a great deal to say, which turns out to hold but small worth. I would rather see a man for myself and judge him with my own eyes.
Odo sniggered into his goblet to see William taken aback for once.
The boy has fine wits,
Odo praised and winked at his nephew. William glared back at his scowling son. He did not like to be reprimanded in public either.
Let us prepare then, my lords, I said quickly, cutting off the impending storm I could see gathering between my son and husband. We have much to do.
Chapter 32 Rouen, Normandy, 1064. Odo rode feverishly for Ponthieu the next morning before dawn. 2 days later, William and his brother Robert rode for Ur to intercept the party escorting the Earl of Wessex and conduct them to Rouen. I called Adelisa and Cecilia to me as the castle awoke into sudden life
with our preparations, so that they might follow my steps and learn how an honored guest, or, in this case, an honored prisoner, should be entertained and treated. Adeliza was almost 8, and Cecilia nearing 7 years of age. Just as their brother seemed to grow as different from each other as fire and ice, so it seemed that was the way with my daughters, too. Adeliza was blossoming into a rare beauty. Her golden hair glowed with the lights of red flame, inherited from her father. Her skin was as smooth and white as alabaster. Her mouth was a dusky pink. Her lips were full, and her bright blue eyes were like a pool of clement waters, burbling in a meadow in summer. Even at this youthful age, she had begun to draw the glances of the men at court to her, and even as I had when I was young, she absorbed looks of admiration with carefully concealed pride. Although she carried herself as a modest maid should, I knew well enough how aware of her own charms she was. Her mind was fine and sharp, strengthened by the intense education I had insisted on for my daughters as well as my sons. One day she would make a strong wife and fine lady for a suitable lord, or even a king. She would make a fine queen, I believed, one who was gracious, charming, and beautiful as the morning sunrise, combined with the subtle powers of the darkened night. She would bewitch all those above and below her, and advise her husband well. She held great promise. Cecilia was different to her sister. In her was the calmness of character that our son Richard contained. And yet, there was more peace in her nature even than he. She hovered at the elbow of her elder sister, and although her features and golden red hair were just as comely as Adelisa's, it seemed as though Cecilia merged into the background, not hiding, but merely unnoticed, in the shadow of her more confident sister. Cecilia was much taken with the teachings of the Bible and the poetry of the Word of God. Whenever I found her alone, she would be sitting in a window seat, basking in the rays of the sun and reading from her volume of the Bible. Her mouth moved softly, as her tongue relished the lilting Latin of the Psalms, and when I found her thus, I could not help but compare her to images of the angels in the stained glass windows of our abbeys and churches, as they basked in the light and love of God. It was, perhaps, this image that had called my attention to the different possibilities for each of my eldest daughters in life. Adeliza was more than suited to the offices of wife and mother, to rule one day over a household as gracious and grand as my own, if not greater. But for my second daughter, for Cecilia, I could see another path emerging, and one that, if handled correctly, would bring her just as much power and influence as her sister, only in a different sphere of our world. In the darkness of our bedroom, as the wind howled outside our castle and William lay spent on top of my body, I had broached the subject of our second daughter and the path I saw her fulfilling in life. "She is much given to religious thought," I stroked William's hair thoughtfully as he lay dozing on my naked breasts. "She would make a fine and noble abbess, a powerful position for any woman, and one that would bring glory to our house and to her." William looked up at me in surprise.
"You would? We should give her to the church? She's a fine-looking child, Matilda. Would it not be better to save her for marriage when the time comes?"
I lifted my bare shoulders, making my unbound hair shine against the light of the few tapers blazing in their sconces in our rooms. Adeliza is the elder, and is already noted by the men at court for her beauty, I said, watching the smoke from the torches dance in ghostly shadows above us. She will be the first to make a match, and we have another two daughters to make marriages for after her. We are honored to have many daughters to give in marriage and make alliance with our countries, my lord, and we will not lack for allies. But I sense a different path for Cecilia. William frowned. Like any father with one daughter or more, he did not like the idea that other men may view them with a roving eye. Although he had had vast pride in the beauty of his elder daughters, he still did not like to think that one day men may seek to do to them the very things he had just taken much pleasure in doing with me. Men can be like that. They believe in a wife being bonny in bed. They do not mind the idea of their daughters being wedded, but the notion of them being bedded is another matter entirely.
Cecilia is very young, he grumbled.
But already wise beyond her years, I contend. We must send our children to the posts and offices that suit them most. There is plenty in our lives we have to give thanks to God for, and what better reward to him than to send one of our own children to his service. Cecilia would become an abbess, perhaps of my own Trinité, one day. She would then be in a position of high authority to aid us, and a servant of God would be of our house. We have three other daughters, William, all of whom look as though they will turn out to be much desired brides. If we grant Cecilia to God, we shall be making but another alliance. Marrying our daughter to God and to his church, instead of to a lord and his house, and she will have a chance to achieve great power of her own. I believe that she is suited in temperament to this path, and it would make her happier than becoming a wife, in the physical sense. I paused. I could almost hear his protests clicking through his mind. If you like, I purred, still stroking his hair. We can withhold her actually taking orders for the time being, until she is older and our other daughters are grown. If we send Cecilia to the church now, as we prepare for this potential conflict in England, then God will understand that we venerate him, honor him. He would look on us with more favor for our sacrifice. I smiled lazily at William. Another coin added to our growing account with God. William yawned, sleepily, showing off his fine set of strong teeth. It was a blessing to me that my husband's mouth had not started to rot, as many men his age suffered greatly from crumbling teeth and sore gums. With care and attention to the nightly cleansing of our teeth, which I had insisted on for my husband and children, even as I did for myself, our teeth were strong and kept white by the application of clean soot and the use of toothpicks after meals.
If her orders are postponed for a time, when she is older, and our younger daughters have passed into adulthood, then I would agree.
William concurred, still with faint reluctance. I nodded. I will break with her on the subject. But first, we must prepare for the visit from our newly captured Earl of Wessex. And on that, my lord, I have another thought.
More thoughts?
William's voice came tired and muffled from between my naked breasts where he had buried his face.
It is awfully late for you to be thinking so much, my love.
What if, in our talks of alliance with Harold Godwinson, I continued, ignoring my husband's obvious desire to sleep, we offered him the hand of Adelisa to secure the pact made between us. Then we are bound not only with holy vows, but also with the promise of marriage.
Six is young to become a wife,
William noted from against my chest. He did not sound happy. Our daughter is seven, William. Almost eight, I chuckled indulgently. He never could seem to remember their ages. And it would be a marriage in name only. until she was of marriageable age. Perhaps 14. William looked up. His face had turned a little grey.
You would rid us both our eldest daughters before they had turned 10?
I shook my head. Adelisa would remain with us, of course, until she reached a marriageable age, I said. But if Harold could be brought to understand that in supporting you, he could become the son-in-law of the King of England and increase his present lands and influence, it may be beneficial to us. He may also appreciate the outside possibility that should none of our sons live to take the throne, then it would be to his children who would stand in line to become king. The Earl would finally hold a blood claim to the throne for his house, something they must have long desired. Perhaps such considerations might sway him to your side as an ally. William cupped my breasts in his hands and stroked them thoughtfully, making my nipples harden at his touch. I shivered with a tingle of pleasure as he did so, but forced my mind to stay on the subject we conversed upon.
He would be a powerful ally, if his ambitions could be satisfied with such trappings of power below the title of king, William noted, his fingers making my breasts quiver with their touch.
Indeed, I agreed. And, with one daughter betrothed to the Earl of Wessex and one promised to Christ our Lord, we would be gaining powerful allies of much use to our house. William lowered his lips to my skin and kissed my breasts. His slight growth of stubble tickled at me, and I giggled as it rubbed against me.
You become wiser all the time, wife, he muttered. And you remain as beautiful as the day I first saw you.
I kissed him. Then we are agreed? I asked. My husband nodded.
We offer our daughters now to God and to Harold, he acquiesced, dropping a sleepy head back to my breasts. But they remain ours in truth and practice until they are older.
I smiled with contentment and resumed stroking his head until he fell asleep on my chest, as I thought long and satisfied thoughts deep into the night. With such thoughts in my head, I watched the attentive eyes of my daughters as they followed me about the castle, making preparation for the visit of Earl Godwinson. The rooms and passages had been aired, fresh rushes had been mingled with sweet-smelling herbs, and made into mats to cover the cold stone floors. Most houses used only rushes and swept them out often to make fresh air, which could become polluted with a fog of sweat, food, and hounds over time. But I liked to mingle dried flowers, sage, and rosemary, thyme, and sprinklings of dried purple lavender buds into our rush mats. Every step taken over those rushes would release sweet scents as they were crushed underfoot, so that the castle smelt fresh and delicately perfumed, like a spring morning. Harold's chambers were hung with rich, painted cloth and tapestry. The bed was aired, changed, and covered with plump blankets of good wool and rich furs. Servants had been appointed to tend to his needs. Harold had 2 pages, 2 squires, laundresses, personal cooks, and watchmen. Although these guards were, in truth, actually set about his chambers to ensure he did not escape at night. The prospect of escaping was slim. His room was in one of the tallest towers of our vast castle, and it would have taken a miracle to drop from a thin window with rope or knotted bedsheets to the far-off ground below. But, still, we wished no chances to be taken. My girls gawped with open mouths and wide eyes when they saw how his chambers had been prepared. Costly ornaments of gold, silver, and precious relics that I had secured were laid out on tables around the set of rooms, rich, red hangings embroidered with thread of gold and silver hung over the bed. Cushions were placed by the fire, and new-sewn undershirts of fine linen, long tunics of fine wool, good hose and cloaks lined with fur, lay in chests awaiting his use. There were ornamented goblets of silver, fine slippers and shoes for his use, and a generous fire of perfumed juniper wood, burning to make his accommodation warm, inviting, and sweet-smelling.
"He must be a most important man to have all this, my lady mother," marveled Adelisa.
Cecilia touched a knuckle-bone of St. Peter in a glorious, intricately carved box, and sat on a cushion of purple velvet with reverence. I watched Cecilia and saw her eyes glowing with veneration for the relic, but also with a touch of want and jealousy. I smiled. Although I wanted my daughter to have due respect for such items and a true desire for her future path in the church, I did not want her to be devoid of all ambition. If she was too submissive, then she could never aspire to become an abbess and leader of a powerful order. Within the holy orders there was just as much competition for advancement as there was outside. The small flash of yearning I saw within her eyes, as she quietly coveted the holy object, gave me hope that under that gentle mask, Cecilia was a woman with as much ambition as I had, and the skill to conceal it when required. She would need purpose as much as piety, and subterfuge as much as sanctity, in order to succeed in the church. "He is the highest and most powerful thane in England." I took a fresh bundle of linen smocks and shirts from a servant who entered, smoothed my hands over the material, and placed them in one of the open chests. "The most powerful after King Edward and your father, the heir to England, of course. We hope Earl Godwinson will become an influential ally for your father in his ambition to become England's king." I paused and glanced at Adelisa. "There is some discussion that you may be promised to him in marriage, daughter," I said gently to her. "What would you think of that?" Adelisa looked surprised, but it was not as though she had been unaware that she would marry a high-born man some day. "Am I not a little young, my lady mother?" "The event itself would not take place until you were older," I agreed. "But many marriages between nobles start as betrothals when those involved are young. Yours would be a marriage in name only, until you reached a suitable age to join with your husband." Adelisa screwed up her nose and pursed her lips. "The Earl is already a grown man," she went on. "He cannot be very young." "It is better for a woman to have a husband older than her," I observed, playing with the ribbon of blue silk on my chest. "Your father is older than I." Adelisa considered my words. "The Earl is very powerful?" she inquired, a shrewd expression of deliberation on her face. I inclined my head, liking that this had been almost her first thought on the matter. It was pleasing to me to see that my own passions had flowed within my daughter's. Power and influence are, after all, what matters in a world of conflict and war. "Are you not going to ask if he is handsome?" I asked her with a smile on my lips. Cecilia was staring at her sister with wide eyes. "That is the question most maids would ask." Adelisa cocked her head to one side. "Is he?" she asked boldly. "We shall soon find out," I said, as I looked from the window, hearing horses on the road down the valley towards Rouen. Cecilia crossed to her sister and embraced her.
"I wish you great joy in your marriage, sister," she said solemnly. Her face looked up into Adelisa's with some trepidation, however. "But I will be sorry if you are to leave home and go to England. I would miss you." I laughed at the seriousness of my Cecilia's expression and gathered both my girls into my arms. "Nothing is agreed as yet,"
and if it does come to pass, then it will not be for some time, I consoled. Until Adeliza is of marriageable age, she would remain with us, and we have yet to ask the Earl his thoughts on the matter, although I would think him a fool if he turned down such a beautiful young bride of such a powerful house as ours. Cecilia nodded, but she gazed wistfully at her sister. As I sent them from the room to wash and dress for the feast that night, I saw Cecilia turn to her sister.
"I think I would be afraid to marry," she confessed in a whisper.
"I am not afraid," Adeliza claimed boldly, taking her sister's hand. "And if you did not want to marry, sister, then you could come and live with me and the Earl and our children. I would make sure you lived well and were looked after." I smiled affectionately as I watched the golden red heads of my girls disappear down the long stone corridor to their own chambers, followed at a respectful distance by their guards. What strange divergences of character each of my many children have, I thought, and how blessed I was to have such variety of choice for their many special talents and personalities. Chapter 33. Rouen, Normandy, 1064. Harold Godwinson, Earl of Wessex, was tall, fair, powerfully built, and mightily handsome. His head shone with the light flaxen hue of the Saxons, and he wore it, as all Saxons did, long, striking a noticeable contrast to the clipped short hair of our Norman lords. He wore a moustache, which hung over his top lip and seemed to accentuate the curve of his fine mouth. This, too, made him stand out, as most Normans, following their duke's habits, were clean-shaven. Harold's eyes were a deep hazel green, and his body was muscular, yet supple. He carried himself with a confidence inherent in all notable warriors I had met, and the eyes of the women and maids of the court shadowed him wherever he went. When I came out to welcome the party of my husband and son escorting our noble prisoner to Rouen, I could not help but admire the striking looks of the Saxon thane as he dismounted next to my husband. Old memories of the sparkling eyes of another fair Saxon fluttered through me as William introduced the most powerful man in England, under the king, to me. My memories of snow were mildly unsettling, and despite the charm and good looks of Harold, I disliked him immediately, because he reminded me of the first and only man who had rejected me. "You are welcomed with all graces to our house, my lord," I curtsied him. "My lord husband informed me of your rude handling by Count Guy. I do hope that you have dealt with the count with all seriousness, husband." I took my eyes from the strong, angled jaw of Harold to the crooked grin of my William.
"I have had words with the count," said William ominously.
What a fine liar my husband was. I had no doubt that Guy was rewarded most generously for having captured such a guest for us.
"And I have promised to make up for the inhospitable arrival of the Earl within the comforts of Rouen, and under your careful ministrations, my lady."
Harold had been watching William closely as he spoke. There were intelligent lights behind the polite expression of the Earl's eyes. I am sure that he understood entirely that he was the captive of my husband. But he also understood that he was in a safer position if he did not draw attention to this fact. However much I would have liked Harold to be a fool, he was no dullard. "We will need to handle all our plans with care," I thought, as I looked at him. "He has a keen mind behind that pretty face."
Harold reached out a hand to me and kissed my fingers softly. His hazel eyes moved from my hand to my face,
and as he reached my eyes with his gaze, I could see a frank admiration for my looks in his gaze.
"My lady," he said, still holding my hand, "many have told tales of your beauty in England, but no words that reached me did justice to you, in truth."
He spoke with a warmth in his voice which seemed honest, and from the naked appreciation he stared at me with, I believed he lusted for me from the very start. William could see it too, and although he hid his immediate, hot anger at Harold, I could see it glowing dangerously beneath his blue eyes. I bowed my head demurely. "Thank you, my lord," I said, assuming an air of modesty. "But I am an old matron now. Perhaps the rumours you heard were of my looks before I married my lord, and became mother to 7 fine children." Harold looked at me with open astonishment.
"Whilst the status of a mother is sacred, my lady, I could never believe that one with a figure such as yours could have borne 7 children."
His eyes roamed over me again, and I could see even more approval in them than before. I liked to remind people that I was a mother of so many, for it shocked them. Most women who had birthed as many babes as I were as thick-waisted as cows amongst the buttercups in summer, whereas I retained the body of a girl. To have a wife who was not only beautiful, but clearly most fertile, was of great benefit to a lord. Harold appreciated my worth, although he, like so many others, only saw my value in terms of beauty and breeding. But still, to this Saxon, as to so many in this world, I must have looked like the perfect combination of womanhood, beautiful, fertile, graceful, and humble. And it was perfectly clear to me from the filmed expression which overtook his eyes that he was already fantasizing about thrusting between my perfect thighs, even as he greeted me. William clapped Harold hard on the back, making the Saxon stagger slightly. I did not doubt that the fierce impact of that apparently friendly gesture was done to appease William's annoyance at Harold's open admiration for me.
"My wife is blessed in the eyes of God, my lord," William declared. "She retains all that was beautiful about her in her youth, and yet gains all that is desirable in a woman of maturity." He smiled at me. "She is the most perfect of all women."
I took William's hand as he kissed mine, and accepted the compliment. It was no less than the truth, after all.
"My husband is overkind to me," I smiled to Harold.
Harold shook his head.
"No, my lady."
His eyes moved across my features and my body with lingering enjoyment.
"No. My lord tells but the truth."
We hurried inside to get ready for the evening's feast. William had ordered that the stay of Harold should be treated as though we were entertaining an honored guest, a fine mask cast over the plain truth.
"Harold admires your beauty," William said, with a note of disapproval in his tone, as he entered my chambers.
Adela was finishing plaiting my hair into elaborate weaves about my head. I smiled at his reflection behind me in the glowing copper plate.
"Many men have admired my beauty. I would hope that you are still one of them, my lord."
William motioned to Adela, who twisted one final piece of hair into place and then left the room. I turned on my chair to him.
"What is it?" I asked.
"You admire me no longer, my lord?"
I teased. William smiled a little, but there was a darkness in his expression not created by the shadows the tapers made.
"He is a handsome lord," he said, his eyes looking deep into my own, and sparkling with sinister and somewhat vicious light. "Many women would admire him in return."
I laughed as I saw to the root of his half-hidden anger. "You are jealous!" my lord."
William's face flashed with anger.
"Have I cause to be?"
he asked. My laughter fell as I saw the look on his face. It was eerily familiar, so like the black rage I had seen when first he ripped me from my horse and beat me to the floor. I stood and walked to him. "My love," I pulled his face to mine. "When have you ever had reason to doubt my love for you? When have I ever given you reason not to trust that all I do is for you and for our house? I care not for a pretty face, though I might admire it. What I care for is you and the life we have forged together." I kissed him, my soft lips finding his and pressing to them, my tongue seeking his as his mouth opened beneath mine. His arms reached around me, crushing me to him in an almost smothering embrace. Forgetful of our fine clothing, I circled my arms about his head and pushed my body against his, feeling the urgency of his passion intoxicating. In one swift movement, William pushed me against the wall of the chamber and pulled up my legs and skirts so that my back was against the wall and my legs were around his waist. He thrust into me as I clung to both him and the tapestry on the wall behind me, feeling the fire of his lust for me as he sought to lay claim to my body. His anger and possessiveness urged him on to rut within me with speed and furious passion. I gasped to feel it. It was exhilarating. My mind was filled with flecks of silver and gold as I gasped and screamed with pleasure. The hard, jealous power of my husband inside me was breathtaking as he moved inside my body with sharp, swift motion. As my thrill reached its knife edge and I fell into bliss, I heard William cry out my name as he climaxed within me.
"I love you, William," I said.
As he leaned his head against me, I kissed him over and over, covering his face and neck with my rambling lips.
"You, and only you."
His tired eyes looked up into mine. Gone was the dark anger of before.
"I know that, Matilda."
He released my legs to the floor and reached down to pull up his clothing. I straightened my dress and picked up the headdress that had fallen to the floor in the midst of his need to stake his claim upon my body.
"Then why the eyes and passions of a jealous man?"
I asked calmly. "I am not saying I mind, my beloved, but still..." William breathed.